major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, since 1985 offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Red Sox owner's raging that the system's out of whack. The owner of the Yankees spends too much. Alas, alack. Should we feel sorrow on behalf of any wealthy strangers? Or should we hold our pity for the A-Rod bereft Rangers? Joining me now to help assign meaning to a baseball universe in which the Yankees have not yet acquired quite everybody is ESPN's Tim Kirkchian, who currently is in Fort Myers, Florida, the spring training home of the Red Sox and their petulant owner. Tim, welcome back to Only a Game.
Great to be here, Bill.
Pundits have argued this week over whether or not the A-Rod trade is good or bad for baseball. You want to weigh in on that?
Well, I hate to straddle the fence here, Bill, but it's good and it's bad. It's really bad for the Pittsburgh Pirates and the Montreal Expos and every other small market team out there that the Yankees' payroll could be six, maybe even seven times larger than theirs. For the game of baseball, there's no way around it. That is not good. Now, having said that, the A-Rod trade by far outweighed John Daly, the Daytona 500, and the NBA All-Star Game altogether last weekend, an off-season baseball trade. And I'm not here to exaggerate, Bill, but you could make a case that this is the biggest trade in the history of baseball, given the guy involved, the level of expertise at which he has played, the two teams involved, and what happened previously in this offseason where he was headed to Boston and now he ends up in New York. I have never seen a story that has captured the attention like this one in baseball. You can love it, you can hate it, but you can't help but be fascinated by this.
All right, so part two of your answer suggests it's good in a public relations sense, but part one, does that suggest that there does need to be some change in the system itself?
Well, of course there does, Bill, and that's what the last basic agreement was all about, and it did fix it to a small degree, and we all knew at the time this was more than a Band-Aid, but certainly not a cure-all, and a lot more needs to be done to make sure that there's a little bit more competitive balance, but we've had non-competitive balance for such a long time, going so far back, not just the last 10 years, but now it is so far out of control with where the Yankees are and where the Yankees will continue to go, that something has to be done. And I'm sure it will be in the next basic agreement, but the thought of the Devil Rays ever being close to the same footing as the Yankees, it's just not going to happen, and everybody has to get used to that idea.
Tim, the latest news in the ongoing Balco steroid scandal has Greg Anderson, Barry Bonds' personal trainer, admitting to federal investigators that he has given steroids to several major leaguers. I almost am going to ask what happens if those players are identified, but it's really more what happens when those players are identified.
Well, this is a very, very tricky story, Bill, and I wish I knew how this was going to turn out. Depending on who you talk to, there's some people in baseball who will tell you that the big-name players, and I won't even name them here, but I think you know who we're talking about, will never be named by Major League Baseball in these suits because, let's say, just for the sake of argument, that Barry Bonds is one of these guys, and baseball announces, oh, yeah, he's been on steroids for 5 years, and all these great things that he's done for the game, just forget about those things. They were done illegally or however you want to phrase it. There's some people who think we'll never get to that point, yet all evidence is pointing in certain directions, and it may be only a matter of time before these names come out that somebody's going to find that smoking gun and we're going to get some real information.
The 1985 drug trafficking trial of Curtis Strong, a former caterer for the Philadelphia Phillies and unofficial cocaine dealer for most of the National League, made public the widespread use of cocaine and other drugs as well among Major League players. Could the Balco trials have the same sort of effect, the same impact in regard to steroid use?
Well, it certainly could, because that drug trial, that trial named people right off the top, and that really did significant damage to those players, obviously to their teams, and obviously to the game. If we get to that point where major league stars are being named publicly in these suits and everything else. Baseball has a lot of explaining to do, because even though steroids really weren't illegal until this last basic agreement, which said, okay, we're going to test for these things now, it's just going to throw a huge cloud over the game. But frankly, Bill, the cloud is already there. There are people out there who are just assuming that anybody who's hit 40 home runs in the last 5 years is doing something illegal. And I think it's time to clear that cloud. And if it means naming a few guys, well, I think you're going to have to do that, if nothing else, just to clear the people who are innocent.
When you talk about clearing the cloud, the Players Union has played a big part in preventing or delaying testing of any kind among its members. But Major League Baseball policies have been pretty lax compared to the policies in other major professional sports. So it isn't entirely the union's fault, is it, that we have the situation we now have?
Absolutely not. I mean, the union is going to fight for its guys, and the union is going to make sure their privacy is protected. That's what unions do, especially really strong ones like this. But this is something that everybody is going to have to come together with, and it's certainly not the union's problem that we have this cloud of suspicion. It's all throughout Major League Baseball, and a lot more work needs to be done on this, and I just can't even imagine where this might be headed in the next 2 or 3 years.
Tim Kirkjian covers baseball for ESPN and ESPN the magazine, and of course he's our regular baseball analyst. Tim, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure, Bill.
Baseball's history is dotted with can't-miss guys who never made it to the bigs. 14 years after graduation, Adam Hizdu still holds his Cincinnati area high school's home run record, an honor he took from Ken Griffey Jr. He was drafted in the first round by the Giants in 1990, but he's never made an opening day roster. When much of the country was turning up its collective collar, Adam Hizdu was at home in Arizona working as hard as ever in the gym. And that's where Mark Moran of member station KJZZ caught up with him.
Oh, be surprised, I'm actually in decent shape, I think. I don't know, I try to get the heart and lungs going as much as I can every day. To me, in order to prepare for what you do, you need to do more than you'll have to do. So that's why I'm in here sucking wind. I'm Adam Hizdu. I grew up in Cincinnati. Was drafted out of high school in the first round and have been playing professional baseball for the last 14 years. In that time, my career has gone from prospect to suspect to prospect to a guy that's competing to make a team. The early part of my career, I never lifted weights. I'd occasionally hit, and I think part of my performance reflected that. Because here I am, a high school guy, and now all of a sudden I'm playing with guys I just watched in the College World Series. And to me, that didn't equate to a fair level of play. And my being a first-round pick didn't compute in my brain to being really good player. It just meant that I was a 15th player taken, and so in my jaded, limited point of view and perspective on the game was that 14 teams didn't even think I could play. So instead of thinking, man, I was the 15th best player in the country this year, I was thinking that there, half the teams in baseball didn't even think that I could help them at all. Try to compete with that. And I just kind of perpetuated that by not working any harder and just assuming that, well, things will just kind of work out. And if I make it, I make it. If I don't, I don't. And so be it. As to a point where, you know what, you got to wake up and realize that you are a good player, you are very talented, and go out and compete. My frame of mind going into spring training is this, and it's changed a little bit over the last couple weeks. Early on when I signed with Boston, I thought, you know what, there's a great chance to compete. Just looking at the numbers that are there, great opportunity. While that chance, opportunity to compete for a job hopefully is still there, the numbers and the sheer amount of players that are in camp with Major League service and time and all that competition has gone up. So while the competitiveness in me likes that, I understand that the more people competing, the less chances you'll have. To look at it in terms of, geez, why do I have to compete with all these other people is kind of a woe is me mentality. And it's unfortunate that those type of emotions still creep in, but I guess maybe you go through the process of being told certain things when you're with the Pirates and those things not coming through, to being told certain things with your new team and hoping it's not the same thing you just went through. My hopes going down this spring are to accomplish a certain amount of respect with my new coaching staff and new front office. And I guess the best way to do that is to perform, you know, get hits, good at-bats, good base running, make all the plays in the outfield. Going in this year, that I'm 32 years old, and you start to think that, you know, I may not have that many more years left. But to me, it would be kind of heartbreaking to look back and say, you know, I quit before I was done. Maybe I could have done something in the game. The season starts April 1st, and it's my intention to be on that opening day roster. I guess we're going to come down the last couple of days in March, and they'll tell us who's on the team. And so my anticipation right now is to be one of those 25 guys on a flight north going to open the season in Baltimore.
Adam Hajdu will be taking a tape recorder with him to the Florida spring training camp of the Boston Red Sox, and we'll be checking in with him from time to time on his progress toward making that roster. It's 18 minutes past the hour.
No cigarettes, no sleep.
There was a good deal of kissing on Valentine's Day this year. Some of it was competitive. In Manila, 5,122 couples engaged in 10 seconds of kissing as the day began, breaking the previous record held by 4,445 puckering Chilean couples. In Italy, Andrea Sarti and his girlfriend Anna Chen battled two other couples for the duration of kiss record. One pair broke it off after a matter of minutes, but Sarti and Chen kissed for 31 hours, 18 minutes, and 33 seconds, breaking a record set 3 years ago by an American couple. Mr. Sarti was rushed to a hospital and treated with oxygen when the kiss finally ended. Ms. Chen reported no ill effects.
All I need is the air that I
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, we talk to two Hoosiers about Hollywood's favorite buzzer-beating shot and more. But first, as the college basketball season continues its long, steady march towards March, the men's bracket still has two unbeaten teams. Number one Stanford and number two St. Joseph's each has a chance to end its winning streak later today. On the women's side, UConn isn't unbeaten for once, but the Huskies still stand atop the coaches' poll. The AP prefers Texas, and the University of Minnesota has dropped out of the top 10 after losing their All-American guard Lindsey Whalen to injury. But as Minnesota Public Radio's Mary Stuckey reports, the team that won their first 15 games and was once ranked as high as number 6 isn't giving up yet.
When the University of Minnesota women took to their home court 2 weeks ago, sending Penn State to its first Big Ten loss, they played, despite a snowstorm, to a sellout crowd of more than 14,000. The first sellout in the history of women's basketball at the University of Minnesota.
They're terrific. They're hard workers. It's an inspiration to watch them play.
And they're fast and they're quick and they're running all the time.
They're awesome. They're sweet.
You know, I think the team is so human, and they reach out to the people. It's just a lot of fun.
Perhaps the biggest draw has been a 5'9" senior guard from Hutchinson, Minnesota. Lindsey Whalen is the all-time career scoring leader for both men and women at the university.
Lindsey Wynn, forward, John McCardle, 22.
But late last week, Whalen broke two bones in her right hand at a loss at Ohio State and may be out for the season. Losing Whalen is a crushing blow. Coach Pam Borton says Whalen has been giving fans just what they want. Thrilling plays, teamwork, and a player of whom the fans can be proud.
She's funny. She's a very unselfish basketball player. She's a great student. You know, you're around her, and there's no way that she carries this type of aura about herself that she's, you know, one of the best players in the country, that she's just a normal kid.
Besides Whalen, Borton gets a lot of the credit for the success of this team. After adjusting to three coaches in three seasons, Borton says the players craved stability.
Last year when we lost to Texas in the Sweet 16, and I was on the airplane sitting next to Lindsey Whalen, and we were just talking about the game, and, you know, it was our last game, the season was over, and she just kind of turned to me and she goes, "Coach, are you going to be back next year?" And I was just like, you know what, that's just not normal.
Whalen says having the same coach return this year focused the team.
It's been great. You know, I know what to expect every day at practice, and I think our coach knows what to expect out of us, and you know, it's just been it's been a lot of fun this year.
The team started to improve in 2001, making it to the NCAA. Last year, with their all-out play and determined defense, the Gophers managed to reach the round of 16. A big change from a few years ago, says Pam Schmidt, who covers Minnesota for the Minneapolis Star Tribune.
Let's just say I distinctly remember being in a game. They wound up losing by 55 points. It was so quiet in the arena that you really could have heard a pin drop. I mean, they're just a different team with a different mindset, and they expect to win now.
But winning without Lindsey Whalen will be tough. This team lacks depth on the bench, which presents a challenge not just this year, but also next. Schmidt says Borton is trying to rectify that.
They will have some very good freshmen coming in, and I think that's going to be a big test of this program because it's gotten to the point now where Pam Borton is bringing in top talent, and some of the best players in the country want to play here.
Reaching the Sweet 16 without Whalen will be hard, and if Minnesota falters in games leading up to the NCAA, their seed could drop, making it even more difficult. Adding to the challenge, says Coach Borton, many of those last games are on the road.
Playing in the Big Ten on the road is very hard. You know, the Big Ten's the toughest conference in the country. You know, anybody can beat anybody on a given night.
But that's good news, of course, meaning the crowd-thrilling University of Minnesota women's basketball team is not out of it yet. For Only a Game, I'm Mary Stuckey in Minneapolis.
Fifty years ago, the boys' basketball team from Milan High, a very small school in Indiana, made its way through the state tournament and in the finals of that tournament knocked off the highly favored team from Muncie Central, a very large school. By now, the unlikely triumph might have been largely forgotten beyond the borders of Indiana if it hadn't inspired the movie Hoosiers, in which Gene Hackman played the coach who led the small-town team to glory, and in which Dennis Hopper and Barbara Hershey also had roles. Today, ESPN will show the actual black-and-white film of the real championship game. No familiar Hollywood faces will be apparent. Because the movie had no audio, play-by-play will be provided by the original radio broadcast. Joining me now to talk about the game with which countless coaches of underdog teams are still inspiring their players is Bobby Plump, without whom the game would have had a different ending and the movie would never have been made. Mr. Plump, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. It's a pleasure to be here.
And also joining me is Phil Razor, who took the court for Muncie Central on that fateful day 50 years ago. Mr. Razor, thank you for joining me.
Good to be with you, Bill, and hello, Bobby.
How you doing, Phil?
Doing fine.
Isn't it wonderful that you're speaking to each other? Just fine.
We're speaking at a distance here.
Now, Mr. Plump, I'm going to run the soundtrack of one of the scenes from Hoosiers. We'll hear Gene Hackman as the coach asking his players to apply a tape measure to the court in the arena where the championship game is to be played.
How far?
10 feet.
10 feet. I think you'll find it's exact same measurements as our gym back in Hickory. Okay, let's get dressed for practice.
Before that real championship game, did you guys need the reassurance that the court was the same size as your court back home?
We really didn't do that. We played at Butler Fieldhouse before because the semi-state has played there. And when we were juniors, we were in the Final Four, so we're going to the Fieldhouse to practice the Friday before that Saturday, the two games for the semi-state. And our coach graduated from Butler, so he knew the ropes, and he was going to take us by the floor before we went downstairs to dress.
Mm-hmm.
And as we got to the edge of the floor, it's almost like there was a big glass there, and everybody stopped, and we looked around, and it, you know, you thought it was a long time, but maybe 3-4 seconds. And finally, Bob Engel, one of our players, said, you know what? Put a lot of hay in this place, couldn't you? And it kind of broke up the thing, so it was similar to what Coach Dale did.
One of the more dramatic non-basketball scenes in the movie has the population of Hickory, the small town, voting to fire the basketball coach. They don't like his strategy. Let's listen to that portion of the film.
I think we should vote again.
Yeah. It's called for a revote. All those in favor of the coach staying, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
Coach stays.
In fact, was your coach ever a man fighting a community that didn't like the way he coached?
There is some truth to that. Marvin Wood, our coach, who was 24 years old when Milan hired him, came in under some pretty adverse circumstances because the coach that coached us as sophomores, Mr. Grinstead, was a very beloved man and had a lot of success, had the best year Milan had ever had. And the superintendent fired him. And they said they fired him because he ordered uniforms, and we needed them. We had holes in our old ones, but we didn't have any money in the budget. So two months later, the school board fired the superintendent that fired the coach. And so when Marvin came to school, we didn't want him there. We wanted Mr. Grinstead. The students boycotted him. He changed our system and did close practice. And the fans really got up in arms and kind of wanted the old coach back. He was still living in Milan and coaching only 4 miles away. So there's some similarities there.
Mr. Razor, you and your teammates came into that championship game as favorites, I would imagine. What did you know about Milan High before the game?
We had a long tradition of winning, and part of that was being familiar with the teams in the state either we played against or keeping our eye on those who we expected to play against. So we knew they played a cat-and-mouse style. They had beaten Indianapolis that way, and we were keeping our eye on Oscar Robertson and Attic. So when they beat Indianapolis, we knew that they were potentially a very strong team.
Now, I assume that you've seen Hoosiers perhaps more times than you wish. did the game, as it's represented in the film, resemble the actual championship game?
I didn't think so, except for the last 20 seconds or so. The game itself, the final score was 32-30, and in the movie itself, it looks as though it's a racehorse, fast-paced game. And, of course, that's part of the cinematography that's being utilized to make it feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
Milan stayed with us. They managed to be ahead 19-11 at the beginning of the second quarter, but we did chip away. And about that time, Bobby came down, crossed the center line, looked over at Coach Wood, and then stuck the ball on his hip. Just stole our momentum right out of us.
Well, it wasn't heavy, Phil. I only stood there for 4 minutes and 15 seconds.
Why'd you do that, Bobby?
Well, it's like I told you before. You know, they ask our coach, why in the world do you have that plump kid standing out there? You got most important game of your life. You're in the fourth quarter and you're down 2 points. And he said, I was trying to think of something to do.
Mr. Plump, in the movie, the high school teacher played by Barbara Hershey says that she doesn't want a high school basketball game to be the highlight of her student's life. Did that game come to assume that sort of importance for either of you?
From my standpoint, not really. You know, there's a big difference between enjoying the past and living in the past. And I've never tried to live in the past. I have enjoyed it. Maybe I enjoyed it more than Phil did that particular game. But as far as enjoying it, yes, I've done that. But it really wasn't the defining point in my life. It's a memorable point. It's something that people remember. It's something that I'm identified with. But I certainly hope there are a lot of things that I've accomplished since then that are more important, I know there are to me, than just hitting that shot or winning a state tournament. after all, it is a game, you know, and, yes. you should enjoy it. And if good things happen to you, that's wonderful. And be thankful for that. But it isn't the be-all, end-all.
Mr. Plump, I'm told that every once in a while, you'll still get a late-night phone call from somebody who wants to know how long that winning shot was when you made it that night 50 years ago. Is that right?
I have received a number of late-night phone calls, and you could listen to the conversation and imagine where they were coming from. Most of the time, it had involved a bet. The score was 31 to 30 or 33 to 32, or the score was tied, and I told this guy it wasn't tied, you know. I get that occasionally. I haven't gotten it as much in the last few years as I did the first probably 40 or 45. None of them wanted to split that bet with me, by the way.
All right. Tonight, in front of live ESPN cameras, the modern-day Muncie and Milan teams will play. Any hope of another Milan miracle? Mr. Razor, you first.
No, what I hope is that these kids, when they get on that floor, will not think at all of that game. These are young guys who are building their own lives, their own sense of competition, their own sense of winning and losing. I hope they go out on the floor, look in the eyes of the other guys, see them as real, and go play their basketball.
And Mr. Plump?
I think Phil's right from a certain extent on that. But it's very difficult for them not to think about it prior to the game with the build-up and the interviews and everything that's been going on. I could almost assure you that when the ball is thrown up, that all of those thoughts are out the window. They're not concentrating on what happened 50 years ago. They're going to be concentrating on having one more point than that opposition. And could it happen? Sure.
Bobby Plump made the winning shot in the Indiana State High School Championship game 50 years ago. Mr. Plump, thank you very much for speaking with me.
You're very welcome. I enjoyed it.
And Phil Razor played for Muncie Central in that game. Mr. Razor, thank you very much for joining me.
Enjoyed it, Bill. Enjoyed it, Bobby.
Phil, look forward to it, my man.
Yep.
The film of the game in which Milan High beat Muncie Central, accompanied by the radio broadcast of the game, will run on ESPN later today. The live broadcast of Muncie v. Milan 2004 will follow. You're listening to Only a Game. On last week's program, I mentioned a rugby team identified as the famous grouse. Simon Gibbons emailed with, as he put it, a famous grouse of my own. It would have been nice, he said, to have heard some coverage of the International Rugby Board World Sevens Tournament in Los Angeles. Mr. Gibbons also informed me that Famous Grouse is actually a brand of whiskey that sponsors the Scottish national rugby team, which perhaps explains why my internet search for a Famous Grouse jersey has so far come up empty. Our conversation about the recruiting misadventures of Florida football player Willie Williams inspired a comment from Lois Butterfield, who hears Only a Game on WOES in Geneva, New York. She wrote to remind me that most colleges, especially colleges that are smaller and less thoroughly dedicated to football than the University of Miami and the University of Florida, recruit athletes on a less lavish scale, and she is certainly correct. Matthew Chamberlain, who hears the program on WLRN in Miami, was, quote, a little pained when Charlie Pierce remarked that the Daytona 500 would be characterized by a lot of guys driving fast and turning left. Fair enough, Mr. Chamberlain, but I hope you'll also acknowledge that Charlie, a.k.a. Mr. NASCAR, also accurately predicted that Dale Earnhardt Jr. would win that race. Joseph Jourdan, who hears Only a Game on WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts, emailed to say, quote, your interesting discussion of Len Miller's book, Silent Thunder, was followed by one of the most banal and ill-informed discussions with Charlie Pierce that I have ever heard. Mr. Jourdan objected to our discussion of the U.S. under-23 soccer team's loss to the Mexican team, which did not mention that Mexican fans had chanted Osama, Osama at that game. Mr. Jourdan concluded by saying, quote, a few colors are missing from your palette. From Cape May Courthouse, New Jersey, Tack Crowley wrote, twice a month I have to get up early on Saturday morning to go to work. I used to hate the early morning drive, but since I discovered Only a Game, I love it. Thanks for making my weekends better. Tell us that you agree, or don't, by contacting us through the website, onlyagame.org. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. The traditional address, onlyagame, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Hotel Commonwealth Boston, located in the Fenway Park neighborhood, near historic mansions, universities, medical institutions, and cultural sites. Information at hotelcommonwealth.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, long-eared owls, ruby-throated hummingbirds, rufous-backed robins, and those who seek them out. But first, our analyst Charlie Pierce joins me for a discussion of the week's sports news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Earlier this week, Colorado football coach Gary Barnett was put on paid administrative leave after what the university president termed, quote, extremely inappropriate and insensitive responses to former UC kicker Katie Hnida's allegation that she was raped by a teammate. This was the fifth rape allegation against Colorado players and recruits to surface in recent weeks, but the first to result in any action against the coach. This was different because?
Well, it was different because it was the fifth but not the last one this week. A sixth case has appeared on Thursday. There is no question in my mind that the University of Colorado football program should be shut down forthwith. This is an ongoing systemic culture of violence and corruption going back way before Gary Barnett got there, all the way to that two-faced, hypocritical Jesus freak Bill McCartney and the renegade program he ran there. It's time for the University of Colorado to take a couple years off from college football and decide exactly what kind of a program it wants.
Just a day after Barnett's suspension, police announced that they were, as you say, investigating a sixth rape claim against the program. Over the past two seasons, nine Colorado players have been suspended for violating, quote, behavior standards. I hate to think what they are at this point. Please tell me this is not entirely the norm for college football, even Division I.
I don't think it's entirely the norm. I think it's closer to the norm than is encompassed by most people's comfort zone. There also seems to be a systematic gentleman's agreement, if one can call these idiots gentlemen, with the local police department, which have actually set up some sort of bizarre liaison with the Colorado Athletic Program to school folks in antisocial behavior, and has turned out to be simply another vehicle for the university to cover up the crimes of its hired athletes.
The NBA's trading deadline passed on Thursday, Charlie, but not before Rasheed Wallace was traded to the Detroit Pistons. I think he played one game for his previous employer. I'm not sure whether he unpacked. What's this all about?
Well, among other things, the trade changes the balance of power in the NBA East, which is not very powerful to start with. Detroit is now a very, very good team, and in my mind, the odds-on favorite to win the conference. Once again, Danny Ainge in Boston confounding the experts and his friends alike by doing something that no one can understand, and adding a couple of players, Lindsey Hunter and Chucky Atkins, which accomplishes nothing to the Celtics but does give the Detroit Pistons some salary cap room. Otherwise, the big story is that Detroit just became the best team in the East.
In the ongoing investigation of Balco, the California laboratory involved with the manufacture and distribution of various steroids, Barry Bonds' personal trainer, Greg Anderson, has admitted to supplying steroids to several professional baseball players. So, will the next edition of the baseball record book set a new record for number of asterisks?
Who knows what they'll do with this? It looks like the grand jury is taking its job seriously. It looks like the feds are taking their job seriously. Remember, this was cited as one of your primary election year distractions. Oh, I'm sorry, points of emphasis in the State of the Union address. So I suspect that if Mr. Anderson doesn't want to spend some time in some very non-luxurious federal housing, he'll be talking about Barry Bonds or some famous athlete fairly soon.
Meanwhile, Greek sports officials have issued denials of a sort to allegations that two athletes and a coach from Greece have been using illegal Balco products. Christos Tsekos denied that he was the coach mentioned, and he called the allegations cowardly and immoral, which is perhaps more headline-grabbing than calling them false.
That's an interesting choice of adjectives. Of course, the interesting thing is these folks are in Greece, and they're not within the scope of the grand jury information in the Bay Area and San Francisco. But I think that this will be an ongoing story throughout not only the baseball season but the upcoming Olympics as well.
Charlie, John Henry, the owner of the Boston Red Sox, opined this week that the system is woefully out of whack. That's a quote. The system he was referring to was Major League Baseball. Is Mr. Henry running for office or just upset that George Steinbrenner is willing to spend even more money than he is?
May I just say, suck it up, Sally. I mean, come on. This guy's got an enormous payroll on his own. He couldn't get the deal done. And now, because the entire ownership of the Boston Red Sox is in place because they guaranteed themselves to be Bud Selig's Bobo for the foreseeable future, John Henry has to poor mouth like a middle market or small market owner.
Another threat to Major League Baseball as we know it was eliminated on Monday when the head of the Philly Fanatic, the big fuzzy mascot for the Phillies, turned up. Wouldn't it have been better if it had stayed lost?
Well, it depends. I mean, it's an interesting story in that an Allentown area man, a radio host, offered $5,000 to bring back the head. And suddenly this Allentown man decides that his kids have found the head of the Philly Fanatic while they were sledding. The fact that there wasn't very much snow on the ground is no reason why we shouldn't believe this heartwarming story. According to Tommy Conwell, who's a DJ on this radio station, the head looked good, but it smelled really bad.
I'm shocked that it smelled bad. The head of a big fuzzy animal.
I just think somebody
bad.
Has to put his head inside the head for 81 games this summer.
We have talked before about the possibility that there will be no next season for the National Hockey League. Is it fair to say that the Washington Capitals are more prepared than any other team for this situation?
Yes. Peter Bondra, your all-time leading scorer, out of there. You're going to Ottawa. They've already gotten rid of Jaromir Jagr and Steve Konowalczuk. I just love to say Konowalczuk, because they've decided that it's better to dub salary than keep faith with their fan base, who is in a barrel of laughs to start with, since the owner persists in beating them up. So once again, you've got a professional sports franchise essentially committing consumer fraud for the rest of the season.
This week, the company that makes AstroTurf filed for bankruptcy. I don't ever like to see any worker lose a job, but I wonder if it wouldn't have been better for everybody who loves baseball if that particular company that makes AstroTurf hadn't failed about 40 years ago.
I think whatever assets they have, including the desks and the copying machines and the typewriter ribbon, should be sent to people like Kurt Warner and other people whose careers were destroyed by this mess.
Finally, Charlie, our ongoing around-the-world search for people determined to set obscure records has turned up an Indian gentleman, known only as Mohad, who has ridden a scooter 90 miles with both hands tied behind his back. So, what's next? Guy going 100 miles and he's blindfolded, too?
I think you have to, but you have to give Mohad credit. He was doing this in a good cause. According to the Press Trust of India, he wanted to, quote, propagate messages of universal education, awareness on AIDS, rainwater harvesting, and the eradication of female feticides. So good for you, Mohad. Please take the police van back home.
Charlie Pierce of the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, eyes wide open, both hands on the wheel or the handlebars, joins me each week at this time for Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
The term the big year, when applied to bird watching, refers to the 365 days during which a competitive collector of bird sightings, bear with me now, scours a particular region, a continent, for example, to see as many birds as possible. At the most competitive level, birding, as the sport's adherents call their passion, can be exhausting, dangerous, and extraordinarily expensive. In The Big Year, subtitled A Tale of Man, Nature, and Fowl Obsession, journalist and birdwatcher Mark O'Masek has chronicled the adventures of three birders simultaneously pursuing a big year. He joins me now in the studio. Mr. O'Masek, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
You chronicle the birding adventures of three men in your book, Sandy Comito, Al Levinton, and Greg Miller. Perhaps we should start with a description of how competitive birdwatching actually works.
It's amazingly competitive. What a big year is a contest to see who can see the most species of birds in North America in a year. There really are few rules and no referees. The idea is just to drive, bike, fly, in some cases even charter a helicopter to try to find birds. These guys were out in the field for 270 days. They traveled 270,000 miles. They lived for weeks on end on a desolate Alaskan isle that was 1,700 miles from Anchorage, but only 200 miles from Siberia. And they hung out there and waited for the strongest or worst El Nino on record to blow Asiatic birds into North American airspace, just simply to count them.
Sandy Comito is perhaps the most driven of the three, although that's a relative term in this context. But tell us a little bit about his motivation.
Sandy is an amazing guy. He is the defending 1987 Big Year champion. He set a record that year that was staggering and amazing, but Sandy, being a birder, is also kind of a perfectionist. He saw others, including some of his friends, try to take whacks at his record over the years, and frankly, I think it really bugged him. He knew that he could do better, and so Sandy, who's the guy who sold me on this story originally, he's a New Jersey industrial contractor. He has a voice that starts about three floors below the basement, a man's man, was just driven to go out and improve on his 1987 record.
And this is rare. I mean, most people, the big year is singular. They don't go out and do it again.
No. In Sandy's own words, he's the only guy lunatic enough to try two big years. His first one cost him $60,000. He came back and did it again. I mean, that's just, it's unprecedented.
A lot of people encountering the stories in your book will be surprised at the pain and the deprivation that birders will endure to see a particular species. What are your favorite examples of harsh environments that these guys braved?
Well, one of them, one of the contestants, a guy named Al Levinton, who, like Sandy, also grew up poor, went on a career bender, worked for years and years, but repressed his love of birding for 40 years. So he came out of the gates 40 years of repressed obsession. Now, for years, the only reliable place in North America to see one particular bird, a Tamaulipas crow, was a place that some called the Corvid National Park. Others called it the South Texas Wildlife Preserve. In fact, it was the Brownsville Dump. So these guys would go out with these scopes as long as your arm, they cost $1,000, mm-hmm. and point these really high-tech Leica, Zeiss, Swarovski optics at these stinking, heaping piles of trash shimmering in the heat waves. Now, there are dozens of people out there all trying to find this one bird. Al Levinton, however, was lucky to have started his career as a laboratory chemist, which blew out his sense of smell. So all around him, his competitors are dropping like flies from the stench. But Al's got his eyes on the prize. He saw the bird.
Greg Miller is the sad sack of your trio. He's overweight. He's chronically exhausted. He doesn't really have the money to finance a legitimate big year. But he's also the only man I've ever heard of who reconnects with his father through birding. I thought that was supposed to happen via fathers and sons going to the ballpark together or playing catch.
This is their ballpark. Greg's father taught him how to bird. Greg is amazing. The first time I went in the field with him, I thought he was actually pulling a David Letterman trick on me. We got out of the car, and he just started calling. Indigo bunting, northern cardinal, sedge wren, marsh wren. He hadn't even lifted his binoculars. Greg Miller was doing it all by ear. There are some people who can identify every Stones song by the first three chords. Greg Miller knows the notes of all 675 homegrown species of birds in North America. You're right. He had no money. What he had, though, was drive. At one point in the big year, Greg Miller lived for 3 days in the Dakotas on nothing more than a jar of Jif peanut butter and a bag of Mr. Salty pretzels. He had maxed out his 5 credit cards, but he really had to. He needed to. He just had to have his Baird Sparrow.
I mean, you bring up a very interesting point here, though. Here's this guy, 3 days, all alone, eating peanut butter and crackers and nothing else. And what's to stop him from coming back to civilization and saying, I saw this and I saw that and I saw 11 of these, too?
That's what I loved.
Even
about
if he didn't.
That's what I loved about this story. There were a million opportunities for these guys to cheat. Now, I was a newspaper reporter for 17 years. A lot of my career was spent chasing politicians, which made me naturally skeptical of what people tell me. I got to say, I gave these guys the once over twice. I gave them the once over 3 times. I could never find a case where these guys made it up. One, Sandy Comito told me, he said, in birding, credibility is like virginity. You can only lose it once. Why, you know, some sports, fishing is based on lying. You know, who catches the biggest fish, the most fish?
Should have seen the one that got away.
Yeah. Birding. Birding is about, in some cases, these guys were actually helping their competitors out.
Well, you tell a story about that. Al Levinton at one point helps Greg Miller by saying, here's where you go, here's where you look, here's the bush where the bird is.
And Al Levinton knows that the bird he's going to show him is probably the one that is going to put him behind.
Mm-hmm.
There's just this code of honor. It's pretty touching. I mean, Al Levinton worked as a CEO. I mean, he's got the big spread up on the mountain near Snowmass. And, I mean, think of all the press of what you've read lately about what CEOs are up to. Here's a guy, basically this grown-up Tom Sawyer, gallivanting around the globe, who's asked by a competitor to help him in this context that is just, he spent tens of thousands of dollars to do. But when the competitor asks him for help, he gives it. I've never heard of a sport like that before.
You know, it strikes me as a little bit sad that Sandy Comito is in such a mad hurry to see as many birds as he can during that year that he doesn't seem to make or have time to enjoy or appreciate the beauty of what he's seeing. You know, he sees something, packs up, runs to catch a plane somewhere else.
Who's to say what enjoyment is? Getting the birds on a list, and that's how they say that they've seen the bird, getting the bird. That's his love. Sandy really, truly does love being in the outdoors. In fact, the first time I birded with him was at the Meadowlands, which was an amazing place because they were tidal wetlands, which meant that the tide had receded and it really stunk like swamp gas. It was next to a landfill, which is a terrific place for attracting gulls. Sandy looks like a little boy out there. He's running around and he's got this big grin on his face. The difference between general birding like that and big year birding is it's a huge difference. Big year, it's a ticking clock. Time is your enemy. Money is your enemy. These guys spent tremendous amounts of time, money. In many ways, it cost them their health. They got really sick because they pushed them. I mean, think about that. 270 days, these guys are waking up at 4 in the morning every day to watch birds. I mean, Sandy has the most unbelievable drive of, I think, anyone I've ever met.
Do you think that folks reading your book will be driven to take up birding, or are they just going to see the pursuit of a big year as completely nuts?
Maybe a little bit of both. There is something about grown people gallivanting around the woods, chasing a creature that has a brain about the size of your belly button that's funny. But on the other hand, you know what? It's fun to do. It's, you know, hunting without killing, praying without punishing, and collecting without clogging your home. What a great way to spend a day.
Marco Masek is the author of The Big Year, A Tale of Man, Nature, and Fowl, F-O-W-L, Obsession. It's published by Free Press. Mark, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Well, thanks a million for having me. It was fun.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Boris Strapatsky and Gennaro Vasquez at Minnesota Public Radio. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear our program again or read a review of The Big Year, visit our website, onlyagame.org. In our final word this week, Charlie Pierce calls for a brief timeout.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Charlie. And the show is over now, so you can go back to sleep. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at BICON.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.